I'm Aryeh Cohen, and this is Daf Shvui, Weekly Daf. Give me 40 minutes or so, and I'll give you a daf or so. But this week, we are doing a rerun, a new to you, maybe, a classic, a conversation with Professor Alicia Gray from Hebrew Union College, which was one of the more popular podcasts. I'm away for a couple of weeks, and so I wanted to re-up that conversation based on Professor Gray's book on charity in rabbinic literature, Middle Ages, and contemporary times, and then we learn a little at the end. I'll see you when I get back. Enjoy. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Yeah, so I figured we just jump right in. The tzedakah material, as you show in your book, the second material that's in the Bavli is not of a piece. It is composed of earlier Palestinian, Tannaitic material, Palestinian Amoraic material, and then material which is homegrown in Babylonia. And there's, of course, a biblical substratum. What are the major ways that you think that the idea of tzedakah changed between these three layers? In other words, like in 30 seconds, what is your whole book about?
Wow, in 30 seconds, what is the whole book about? That assumes I remember what the whole book is about, even though it was published not that long ago. Well, what changes in the Bavli, I mean, what struck me, I mean, what I could tell you about is what still strikes me is very interesting, is first of all, the attitude toward the poor changes, which is interesting. You do get some interesting developments between the Tannaitic period, the period of the Amoraim of Eretz Yisrael and the Bavli. One particular change is that the Amoraim of Eretz Yisrael tend to be very warm towards the chronically poor. The Bavli seems to have more of a sense of distance. It's not at all that they think that tzedakah is not a mitzvah, far from it, but they tend to have more of a sense of distance from the chronically poor. The Bavli tends to prefer the working poor. It's very warm towards the working poor, but the poor that accepts tzedakah, there's a bit more of a sense of distance.
I'm going to jump in here just for a minute to clarify for our listeners who might not be as ingrained in this material as we are. Difference between Tanaim Amoraim and Bavli and Yerushalmi?
Yes. The Tanaim are the sages of the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Midrashim on the books of the Pentateuch. These are scholars that are active in the second and third centuries. The Mishnah is the magnum opus of the Tanaim. It comes into existence as a compilation roughly around the year 200. The Amoraim, you have the Amoraim, who are the sages who succeed the Tanaim. There are Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael who are active from the third through the end of the fourth century, and there are Amoraim in Babylonia further to the east, who are active from the third through the late into the fifth century. And then, of course, there's the coming together of the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli. In each place, that may happen somewhat later, whether a little later or a lot later. Scholars continue to debate that, but a bit later than the Amoraic period. So when we're looking at this material, as you indicated, we have to be sensitive to these various strata. Tannaitic material, which tends to be earlier and from the land of Israel, Amoraic material from the land of Israel, material from Babylonia. So you have these geographical and chronological strata, and the careful scholar has to be cautious about sort of trying to keep these threads distinct so that we get the best possible picture we can of what the material is actually telling us. So as I was saying before about the different attitudes toward the poor, when we tease apart these textual strata, we can see these different attitudes toward the poor. And the other thing that I wanted to note about something that struck me as I was researching and writing the book about the attitude of the Talmud Bavli is that the Talmud Bavli, for all that it presents various theological, different religious ideas about charity, nevertheless, it has this profoundly, for want of a better word, I'll call it a humanistic strain. The Talmud Bavli really tends more than the earlier compilations from Eretz Yisrael to emphasize the human-to-human aspects of charity and to try to limit the divine role while accentuating the human role. And that really is something that I continue to find fascinating.
That struck me a lot, especially the distinction between in the Bavli, where it seems that there are more stories or more about actual
people who are poor who are getting money, as opposed to the earlier strata where the poor are almost not there. They're just kind of a function.
Yes. That's particularly a contrast between Tanaitic literature, the literature of the second and third centuries in the land of Israel, where the chronically poor pretty much are absent, as you indicate. They're really not there. I mean, you're giving the money to somebody, but they're not there. And the poor make a greater appearance in the Amoraic literature of Eretz Yisrael, which, as I indicated, is more warm to them. And the Bavli, you know, how this manifests itself in the Bavli is, for example, the Bavli's attention to distinguishing between, on the one hand, the realm of what's called Hekdesh, the realm of the sacred, the realm of the temple, distinguishing between that and charity, even though the connection between Hekdesh, the realm of the sacred, and charity goes back before the Bavli. It's a feature even of non-rabbinic Jewish culture. We see that in epigraphic evidence from synagogues, archaeological evidence. Nevertheless, the Bavli is determined to sort of just not emphasize that, not see that as the most important aspect of charity. You know, Hekdesh is not tzedakah. Tzedakah is not Hekdesh, to paraphrase a statement in Masechet Arachim.
That's fascinating, because also over the years, a Hekdesh becomes, and also in the Islamic Waqf is pretty similar, that it becomes like the ombudsman or the owner of like synagogues and places like that, which is not tzedakah. But it brings up this kind of elision that happens, less so in the Bavli, but as you point out in the Yerushalmi, between giving money as tzedakah to support poor people, materially poor people, and giving money to support rabbis.
Right. Well, that is an interesting thing. I mean, there is that interesting little story in the Talmud Yerushalmi and Megillah about how a rabbi is given funds to support various vulnerable people, and he diverts the funds to rabbis. And the Talmud Yerushalmi sort of goes with the flow. I mean, it's kind of okay with it. Rabbis are, you know, a fitting set of recipients of tzedakah. But that also connects with a larger difference between the two rabbinic cultures. And this is something that my teacher, Richard Kalman, had already pointed out many years ago, that the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael, they're fine with accepting gifts from wealthy non-rabbis. Bring it on. Give it to us. Support us. They're fine with that. In Babylonia, and this is something that I've developed myself much more, the Babylonian rabbis, they understand the uses of wealth. They understand that that can be important, but nevertheless, they construct themselves as being independent. They construct themselves. You have parade examples of Babylonian Amoraim who mysteriously rise to wealth as they become known as rabbis. Where does the money come from? They rise to wealth. They become wealthy. The rabbis in Babylonia, they're willing to accept gifts under the heading of priestly gifts. In other words, we, the rabbis, are now the appropriate recipients of priestly gifts, but they don't, like the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael, they don't really want to be seen as just taking from other people. And whereas the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael are not unwilling sometimes to portray themselves as materially impoverished, you really see very, very few, not none, but very, very few Babylonian rabbis presented as materially poor, and they don't even valorize it ideologically. Rabbi Yochanan in Leviticus Rabbah, a great midrash from the land of Israel, is portrayed as selling off everything he owns to fund his Torah study. No way is a Babylonian rabbi going to do that. You don't get those portrayals there. So
you have also the story of Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Elezer, where Rabbi Elezer is a poor blacksmith, but again, a Palestinian figure, even though Bavli.
Right.
One of the other fascinating things that you write about is that the rabbis in the Bavli arrogate to themselves the role of distributor of alms. Right? They're not the recipients. This is an innovation, as you point out. It also replaces the earlier notion of tzedakah as gift to God or as akin to sacrifice, as you just mentioned. At the same time, the rabbis laud the support of other rabbis who are not materially poor sometimes. So what is going on here? Is this just or also a rabbinic power play?
Well, it may be that. It may be that, look, if you want to increase your influence and spread your influence in society among people who are not necessarily receptive to your message or who don't yet know that they want to be receptive to your message, You know, what are you going to do for me? Well, feed me, take care of me, do something for me. So this is certainly a way to do it. You make yourself indispensable socially in a particular way, and then you create a receptiveness to your message. In the book, I find that portrayed actually in Genesis Rabbah, a midrash of the land of Israel, very poignantly and directly, where the patriarch Abraham is presented as sort of using his hospitality as a way to convey a rabbinic message. But I think that something like that is tacitly at work even in Bavel. You know, we are the ones who will take care of you, and therefore you can listen to our message. So I don't think, even though the rabbis in the Bavli, the Babylonian rabbis, appear to be insular, they appear to be talking to themselves a lot of the time. Of course, they want to have influence. They see themselves as the representatives of Torah. They want to be seen as such. And the way to do it is by providing people what they need, making themselves indispensable.
Right. Yeah. They also, in the Bava Batra material, there's also lots of regulations about how to make sure that the system appears has integrity, right? That they two people have to walk together. You're not allowed to take out from one bag to put in another bag.
Right.
You're not allowed to mix up your money with the money for tzedakah, because, you know, if they, on the one hand, they put themselves up as the distributors of tzedakah, but they want to make sure that people will give it to them.
Correct. That's right. And that's also the reason that in Bava Batra, later than that Braita that you just referred to, there's the emphasis that the scholar who's appointed over the tzedakah pouch has to be of the stature of the Tannaitic hero, Rabbi Hanina ben Taradion. So in other words, you have to have a sage that has a certain stature, so, you know, a certain level of integrity and ethical probity to be in charge of the tzedakah pouch.
Right. And I've always been struck by the fact that they call Yerushalmi actually more forcefully than the Bavli, calls the distribution of tzedakah dinei nefashot, capital law.
Correct.
Recognizing how important that is.
Yes. And even to the point, as you know, that they wonder, well, if it really is that, then maybe there should be 23, just as there are 23 judges on a Sanhedrin Katana, a small Sanhedrin, to adjudicate capital punishment. Maybe there should be 23, but of course, that's not very practical.
Right. I think Rashi on the spot says that if you waited around for the 23, people would die.
Right. It would sort of defeat the point.
Yeah. Right. To change the topic a little bit, one of the transformations, or maybe supersessions, I don't know if that's the right word, that you delineate is redemptive almsgiving is generally disfavored in the Babylonian Talmud or by the Babylonian sages. Why is that? And could you talk about how Torah study, surprisingly or perhaps not, slips into the equation?
Yes. Well, redemptive almsgiving, I mean, it's interesting. I'm not sure to this very moment that I could, you know, offer an explanation of exactly why it is. But, you know, to me, it's all tied up with the fact, you know, the larger point that in Babylonia, they seem to be much more interested in delimiting the divine role and accentuating the human role. And redemptive almsgiving really implicates the divine role. Giving charity, you know, forgives sin. Well, this isn't necessarily something we want to emphasize. And I just kept finding it again and again, these evidences of ambivalence. But even so, as I point out, I mean, there is a braita that is that appears several times that makes the point quite directly that redemptive almsgiving, if that's your explicit motivation for giving, that doesn't necessarily undermine the religious value of the giving. But the Bavli, it seems to me, is quite ambivalent about it. And as I said, I do think it's just related to this effort to delimit the divine role. They want to turn down the volume on the divine element there in tzedakah. They really do want to elevate the human. The other chiddush that I, the other novelty, novel idea that I think I have in the book about that is, I do believe that that is a thread in the Bavli, and I believe that after the Talmud in the 12th century, Maimonides is the medieval sage who I think most perceptively and holistically picks up on that thread in the Bavli, but that could be our topic maybe for another podcast.
Right. And that actually, I mean, that seems to make sense to me. That made sense to me on another level, because Maimonides is trying to downplay divine intervention in the world in general.
Precisely.
And so Yeah. One of the interesting things about redemptive almsgiving is that it's in direct dialogue with the Christians, the early church fathers. And so I would love it if you could just say a few words about the world in which the rabbis' ideas of charity lived and how the rabbis were kind of in dialogue with these other religious groups around tzedakah.
Right. Well, both the rabbis and the contemporaneous, the Christian sages and thinkers of late antiquity, both of them really inherit redemptive almsgiving from the Second Temple period. And the scholar Gary Anderson, in his book Charity, which was published in 2013, Anderson does an excellent job of tracing these ideas in the book of the Hebrew Bible's Apocrypha, the book of Tobit, the book of Ben Sira. You already see in a late stratum of the Hebrew Bible itself, in the book of Daniel, chapter 4, verse 24, you see what looks pretty explicitly as a mention of using the Aramaic word is tzidka, which is the Aramaic for the Hebrew tzedakah, using tzidka to redeem your sins. So these ideas appear in the Second Temple period already. You see some echo of them as well in passages in the New Testament. So the rabbis are not necessarily borrowing per se from their Christian neighbors, whether in the Eastern Roman Empire or in Sasanian Babylonia, but they both inherit these ideas from the past. But there are differences in the way these ideas get expressed in the Christian world. And here I speak with some diffidence because I'm not an expert on the Christian material. But what it does seem to be the case is that you have a tendency to sort of exalt the poor, even though scholars like Helen Ree and others who are experts in that material point out that Christian fathers are very well aware that not all the poor are saintly, not all of them take their poverty with the spirit of Christ. But nevertheless, there is a tendency to see the poor as sort of living martyrs, as intercessors, such that giving tzedakah to them sort of buys you that access to heaven. The rabbis don't exalt the poor in that way. Even the Amoraim of Eretz Yisrael between the third and the late fourth centuries, who are very warm toward the chronically poor, even they don't go to that extent. They don't see the poor as living martyrs in that sense, as intercessors. So these ideas are indeed percolating. And in the fourth century, redemptive almsgiving becomes quite a dominant doctrine in the churches. The scholar Peter Brown has written about this, how the Christian idea that it's not the difference between the citizen and the non-citizen, but it's the difference between the rich and the poor that make all the difference. The idea then that the poor become very significant in Christian theology, the idea that the redemptive almsgiving transaction comes to be viewed as gift exchange with the poor person, perhaps paradoxically, as the one who gives the gift to the gift of salvation to the rich donor, sort of flipping the roles here. This is, you know, these ideas are very prevalent. So, of course, it's not a surprise. The rabbis, again, inheriting these ideas from the Second Temple period, the rabbis operating in a world in which, as we move into the fourth century, these ideas become much more prevalent and become such a feature of Christian piety and practice. It's no wonder that we're going to see these ideas in the rabbinic material. But the task for the scholar of rabbinic literature is to say, it's not enough just to point and say, okay, I can see these ideas. The question is, how do the rabbis represent them? How do the rabbis refract these ideas through the prism of their own rabbinic approaches to Torah? And that's where we see some of these differences. And again, in Babylonia, yes, the idea is there. It's in the Babylonian Talmud. But again, arguably, I discern a sense of ambivalence about the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like my grandmother would agree with the Bavli, because she always used to say, money can't buy you happiness, but as long as you're going to be miserable, you might as well be rich.
Well, there you go. But I have to say, if I have just a second to tell a funny anecdote, in July, I was in Jerusalem for a charity conference at Hebrew University, and I happened to be waiting for the light rail up at Ammunition Hill. And there was someone who was walking around asking for tzedakah, and a young man went to give to him. And there was this old lady who started screaming, "Don't give to this person. I know for a fact this person is a fraud. Don't give to this person." And the young man who was giving said to her, "Kapara, atonement." In other words, "I'm giving as atonement." And she yells, and of course, all of this is happening in very high volume Hebrew. She yells back at him, "Don't give me this about kapara, knock it off." And I thought, you know, what has this been set up for my benefit? I'm here to be talking about this material, and this is unfolding right in front of me. So in other words, lest anyone think this is not current events, I'm here to tell you it is.
It is. Yeah. So actually that leads right into my last question before we learn a little. That you write about tzedakah drawing from a variety of religious concepts, temple sacrifice, atonement practice, Torah study, poverty relief. And now, beyond that, today, in the contemporary world, what of this universe of associations do you see echoed in our tzedakah practices?
Well, that's an interesting question, which is why I was fascinated to get into some of what I went into all too tersely toward the end of the book, because I find that our contemporary tzedakah practices move in different directions. On the one hand, tzedakah merges with a larger social justice agenda, which is very understandable and of course, supported by the semantic field of tzedakah. So it blends into that. And on the other hand, there's been this fascinating, to my mind, resurgence of some of these, you know, real religious ideas about tzedakah that, you know, particularly in the Anglophone world had disappeared for a long time. One of the interesting things, as I point out in the conclusion to the book, is the reemergence, even in the 2015 Reform High Holiday Machzor, Mishkan HaNefesh, you know, look what came to Yizkor. Tzedakah returns to Yizkor. So I do find that there's this duality. On the one hand, tzedakah merging with a larger social justice agenda, a very human-centered agenda. And on the other hand, sort of the revival of these religious ideas that at least in certain Jewish communities might have been thought to be moribund and defunct, and yet they're coming back. The whole idea, the challahs in the ark kind of a story, you know, the idea of a person thinking that they're giving something to God and in reality they're supporting an impoverished person, the prevalence of that story and its republication in various edited collections is fascinating.
Could you just tell the story in short for people who haven't yet read the book?
Yes, there are very many versions of it. But in a nutshell, you have a situation where a person gets the idea in his head that he's going to give challahs to God. He thinks that what he's doing is fulfilling the commandment to the priests to put the showbread on the table in the temple. So he gets it in his head. This is a good thing to do. He brings, two, three, however many challahs a week. He puts them in the ark in the synagogue, thinking he's giving them to God. At the same time, unbeknownst to this gentleman, there's a poor person who comes by and every week sees the challahs, the person needs them and takes the challahs. So you have this interesting tzedakah transaction that unfolds unbeknownst to both of them. The giver doesn't know, he thinks he's giving to God. The taker doesn't know, he thinks he's taking challahs. And then at some point they discover each other. And here's where different versions of the story move in different directions as to whether this is a happy discovery, an unhappy discovery, the involvement of a rabbi who either sees this as a good thing or not. But it's a fascinating story. It has been transmitted in different versions in different Jewish cultures. And as I indicated a minute ago, it continues to be republished in contemporary anthologies of Jewish stories. There's even a website about this as a pay it forward sort of practice. So obviously this is speaking to people. For all that it seems to be a strange, archaic way to think about tzedakah, it is speaking to people.
It's fascinating. It's a fascinating way that people are doing do-it-yourself Judaism, but drawing at the same time on very traditional concepts and concepts that we thought might have gone away.
That's right.
I was fascinated by that. I had no idea that the Reform movement was bringing back tzedakah in Yizkor.
Well, I hadn't known until I sat in shul and opened the machzor. I mean, nobody told me. I was like, wow, yeah, look what came to Yizkor. Wow.
Okay, that's great. So you want to learn a little?
Yeah, let's learn.
So we're going to open, for those at home, I'll put up a link to this on the podcast page. We're on page, 10A?
Yes.
10A, and we'll start like three lines down from the top in the edition published by the widow and brothers Raim in Vilna.
Thank heaven for them. Okay.
Thank heaven for them. You know, the building still exists, apparently.
Oh, really?
It's not a printing press anymore.
Okay, well, if we can ever fly again to Europe, maybe I'll go there at some point.
Here you go. Okay, so do you want to read? I'll read.
I'll read. It's fine. So if any of my students are listening, they can get a giggle. I'm reading. Okay. Okay. Tanya haya Rabbi Meir Omer, yesh lo leba'al din lahashiv cha v'lo mar lach. I mean, I'll stop. I don't know if you want to translate or how you want to go with it.
Let's read and translate.
Okay. So it was taught, Rabbi Meir would say, there, you know, a litigant could respond to you and say to you, Im Elohechem ohev aniim hu, if your God loves the poor, mipnei ma eino mefarnasan, why doesn't he support them? Emorlo, so if he says this to you, Emorlo, say to him, Kadesha nitzol anu bahen medina shel gehinom. Say to him, this is in order that we may be saved by means of them from the judgment of hell. Vizo she'ela sha'al tornis rufus harasha et Rabbi Akiva. And this is the very question that the evil tornis rufus asked Rabbi Akiva. Im Elohechem ohev aniim hu, mipnei ma eino mefarnasam. If your God is a lover of the poor, why doesn't he support them? Amarle, Rabbi Akiva responds to Tornus Rufus, Kedei shenitzol anu bahen medina shel gehinom, in order that we may be saved by means of them from the judgment of hell.
Well, we could start. We could start talking about it here.
Okay. I mean, I just think it's worth pointing to the this opening question as sort of the setup.
Yeah, I actually went when I was going over this, you know, whatever it was that I was doing this for the podcast, I kind of went down into a rabbit hole on Baal Hadin.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out where that came from and was not, I mean, I know that, you know, it's used as kind of polemicist or antagonist or something like that, but it's, to put it in as a litigant, as you said, is, you know, to put it in a judicial context is interesting, I thought.
It is interesting, and it is strange, and it's interesting from the very beginning. You know, yesh lo ba'al din lahashivcha, that the ba'al din is responding to you and saying it to you. So yeah, it is interesting. So it's some sort of, I mean, I guess it would be some sort of antagonist, someone who is sort of attacking the what is perceived to be here, the rabbinic, the Israelite approach to the God of Israel and the way the God of Israel works in the world, somebody who is opposed to this.
Right. And it seems that this is, in a certain way, it seems that this is coming in the middle of a conversation.
Yes.
Right. If the other guy wants to retort this, meaning that something was already said, and maybe what was already said is we should support the poor, or God is a philoptochos, a lover of the poor. And then he's going to say, oh yeah, well, if that's true, then why doesn't God support the poor? And this kind of brings to mind the beginning of Tanit, where, or in other places where they have these scenes, dramas of the end of days where the nations of the world come to God and God says, you know, what did you do? Why do you deserve to not be consigned to hell or whatever it is that the punishment is.
Right.
And here it seems to be trying to undermine the whole system.
That's right. Why are you doing this? God should do it. And again, as I point out in the book, what I find interesting is if you comb through the Hebrew Bible, it never really says that God loves the poor. So, I mean, even that whole idea, if God loves the poor, the premise of the question is actually unsupported, at least by the Hebrew Bible.
Right. And this is the only place that it's used.
Correct.
It's used a lot, and this is like one of those places where it's obvious that this is a borrowing. I don't know, obvious, but it's because it's used in the Christian literature.
Correct. And this entire sugya, as I point out in the book and even previously when I published on it, this sugya, even though it mentions the Tanaim, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Akiva, is as authentically Tanaitic as if Rabbi Akiva was using an iPhone. I mean, this entire thing betrays lateness all over the place. I mean, it really is, it's purely a Babylonian creation. You know, we don't need to go into all that now, but that's right. I mean, it's found in Christian sources. This is clearly designed to be a polemical text.
And I think it's also interesting that it's Rabbi Akiva versus the Romans, because there are other also famous Bavli texts, which are some like the famous martyrdom text of Rabbi Akiva, which is not a, which the Bavli portion is not a martyrdom text. It's just a resistance text. Again, there seems to be a Babylonian Rabbi Akiva.
Yes.
Who serves specific Babylonian ends.
Correct. Which is not surprising. That's right. The Babylonian Talmud constructs its Rabbi Akiva for its particular religious purposes.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Should we go on?
Sure. Amar lei adaraba zosha mechayev tam legehenom. This is precisely the thing that's going to make them liable for Gehenom, says Tornus Rufus. Em sholecha mashal lemaha davar domeh. I'll give you a parable. What does this resemble? It resembles...
We have to just point out that it's the Roman governor guy who's doing midrash. I mean, just...
Exactly. It puts us all to shame, right? This, the evil Tornus Rufus can do midrash. So he says, Lamelech Basar Vadam, the situation resembles that of a flesh and blood king, Shaka'as Alavdo, who became angry at his slave, Bechavsho Beveta Asurin, and he locked him up in prison. Betziva Alav Shalola Ha'achilo V'Shalola Hashkoto. He commanded that the person not be fed and not be given to drink. V'Halach Adam Echad, and a certain person came along, V'Ha'achilo V'Hishkeu, and he fed him and he gave him to drink. Kishashama HaMelech Lo Koes Alav. When the king hears about this, won't he be angry at him? V'Atem, and you Jews, Kuruyin Avadim, you are called slaves. Shene'emar, as it says in the Torah, Ki li b'nei Yisrael Avadim. The Israelites are slaves to me, meaning to God. And again, fascinating. Poverty is prison. The person who is imprisoned is impoverished. The person who is giving him to eat and drink is the person giving tzedakah. Tornus Rufus's parable is fascinating. Won't the king, won't God be angry? God wants to punish this person, to imprison this person in poverty. Who do you think you are coming along and giving them to eat and drink? This is impious.
I think that, yeah, exactly. And I think that's fascinating. And two other things fascinating here. One is that it is just a given that poverty is violent.
Correct.
Right. And so that, I mean, we have that later on with the Rabbi Binyamin story.
Yes.
We have, you know, and so it's just, that's just a given. They know that poverty is violent. And the second thing that confuses me is always confusing when it says all of Kilib Nei Israel, but for Israel is our servants to me. So all of Israel are servants. So who's then the one giving the tzedakah?
Right. Well, it would presumably be one slave who is rebelling by demonstrating solidarity with another.
Oh, that's interesting, right? Because it's v'halach adam echad.
Right.
That adam, I mean, you know, obviously, according to the parable, that adam would have to also be an Israelite.
Right.
But it doesn't really, it's kind of funky with the all of Israel are, and you, because you are called slave, right?
So right.
Adam echad, because you are called slaves. And so then who is the one Adam?
Right. You're right that there's a certain ambiguity there, but I do see it as assuming that it is Israelites. In other words, you are all slaves. There's an impious act here, and that one slave is then flouting the will of the master. The master wishes to punish slave A, and slave B goes and sneaks him food. I mean, that's... How could that possibly be something, says Tornus Rufus, that God would approve of?
Right. Though I'm actually thinking right this minute, obviously anachronistically, maybe anachronistically, that this could be kind of a proof text for solidarity, that it's, you know, the Adam Echad is not of the slaves, but an outside person. That's probably not.
It's an interesting thing to think about.
Because it uses the term Adam, which is kind of generic person,
right,
as opposed to
Israel. Right. It's not V'halach Yisrael Echad. Right. It's V'halach Adam Echad. True. And it's worth thinking about. But I think even whether it's generic or not, I do think the solidarity point is there. But the construction of, you know, Tornus Rufus's dark vision is also noteworthy. I mean, his vision of the relationship between God and Israel is really dark. I mean, it's a master-slave relationship. It's characterized by anger, by violence. This is the relationship, such as demonstrating this solidarity is something that God will presumably punish severely. This is not something that God is going to appreciate. It's just really a very dark vision.
Yeah, it brings to mind, this is probably inaccurate, but it brings to mind the Protestant notion of if you are rich, that means you have found favor in God's eyes. Not the prosperity gospel, but the world is determinist, and all you can do is live out your role, more or less. But if you are, so therefore, if you're poor, there's something wrong with you.
Right.
Spiritually. And that's what Turner Sophus is saying.
Right. That's right. There's something wrong, and don't interfere, because there's something wrong. The person is this way because that's the way it's supposed to be. So butt out, basically.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Rabbi Akiva has to respond to this. So Amarlo Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva says to him, as I put it in the book, he fights parable with parable. He says, I'm sholecha mashal, l'maha davar domeh, so I'll give you my parable. This is comparable to l'melech basar v'dam shaka'as al b'no. This is comparable to a human king who became angry at his child. V'chivsho b'veit ha'asurin, he again imprisons him. V'tziva alav shalo l'ha'achilo v'shalo l'hashkoto. Don't feed him, don't give him to drink. And again, v'halach adam echad v'he'echilo v'hishkeyu. A certain person comes along and gives him to eat and gives him to drink. Kisha shama ha-melech, asks Rabbi Akiva, when the king hears about this, lo doron mishagerlo, won't he send this person a gift? In other words, won't he be grateful? And then he says, v'anan kruyin banim, we are called children. Dichtiv, as it's written, banim atem ladonai Eloheichem. You are children to Adonai, your God. So fascinating. You know, Rabbi Akiva says, you want a parable? I'll give you a parable. In this case, yes, we have the king. That's God. But we're not talking about a slave. We're talking about the child. The king gets angry at his son. But is he going to stay angry? Isn't the king going to be moved to mercy by the fact that somebody shows mercy on his child? The king will relent. That's Rabbi Akiva's claim.
Though it's kind of an abusive relationship.
Well, I would say it's not the one that, anybody really would like to have. Right. The king is portrayed as somewhat capricious.
Which is a theme in a lot of Tanaitic Midrashim.
Yes.
The king who kills his son or exiles his son, and then somebody has to come in. But like you say, again, here, it's the king who's punishing the son, but wants somebody to transgress the punishment.
Right. The king seems to have a rachmanis, a mercy deficit, but the king's rachmanis is triggered, is moved by the fact that he sees somebody intervening to take care of his son. And it's fascinating to see here the use of this word doron, which appears a little bit later on this daf in a redemptive almsgiving context explicitly. It appears in Masechet Zvachim, the page eludes me at the moment, in a sacrificial context. In other words, the word doron has intertextual resonance with all of these ideas. But here it would be the king that gives the doron out of gratitude for the person sort of saving the king's son from the king.
Right. And just, and also the fact that they use the word doron, which is of Greek origin.
Yes.
To rather than some other word, to reinforce possibly the anachronistic nature of the Breita.
Right. You know, wink, wink. Right. We have something else going on here. Tornus Rufus has an answer. He's a Marlo. He says to him, Atem kruyin banim kruyin avadim. I mean, okay, you're called sons and you're called slaves. Bizman sha atem osin ritzono shel makom, atem kruyin banim. When you're doing God's will, then you're called sons. Ubizman sha ein atem osin ritzono shel makom, atem kruyin avadim. And when you don't do God's will, you're called slaves. Viachshav, and right now, at the present moment, ein atem osin ritzono. No shel makom. You're not doing God's will. How do we know they're not doing God's will, I would ask? The answer is because this is a period after the destruction of the temple. This is a period of hester panim, as it were, the hiding of the face. In other words, Tornus Rufus is rubbing Rabbi Akiva's face in the situation that Israel finds itself in at the present time. Yeah, you might be sons, but not now.
He's basically saying the fact that I am here and I am the ruler, and the temple is destroyed, shows that you're not doing the will of God.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think that this is also kind of a paradigmatic or prototypical rabbinic moment, the fact that they don't even have to explain why, how we know that Israel is not doing the will of God, because one of the themes of the Bavli is that it's a post-Churban, a post-destruction text.
Yep.
And this is kind of a central narrative of the text, is the destruction.
Right. He alludes to it very clearly, but indirectly. And that's right. You know, here it is. That's right. I'm here. You're there. You're the slaves. So my parable is the correct one.
But Rabbi Akiva gets the last word.
He gets the last word, but he retreats a little bit. He says at this point, Amarlo, he says to him, Harei hu omer, and now citing Isaiah 58:7, Halo faros l'ra'ev lachmecha va'aniim rudim tavivayit. Is it not to give, distribute your bread to the hungry and to take the wretched poor into your home? Ematai aniim rudim tavivayit. When is it that you're going to take, that you should take the wretched poor into your home? Ha'idana, now. The Ka'amar, and it says, Halo faros l'ra'ev lachmecha. Isn't it to deal your bread to the hungry? As I read it, and you know, we could have a conversation if you disagree. As I read it, what Rabbi Akiva has done is he's made a bit of a journey here. He begins this sugya with a robust presentation of redemptive almsgiving after his contretemps with Tornus Rufus. By the end here, he doesn't explicitly renounce redemptive almsgiving, but he retreats. He falls back on Isaiah 58:7, breaking apart the two parts of the verse as if to say, look, at the end of the day, this is the right thing to do now. This is what the verse says. When are you to take the wretched poor into your home? Ha'idana, right now, you are to distribute your bread to the hungry. In other words, I'm not going to get into more discussion with you of whether God will reward the tzedakah or God will not, or whether God's happy or unhappy. At the end of the day, Isaiah 58:7 says, this is the right thing to do right now. So he retreats somewhat from a robust presentation of redemptive almsgiving. And this by itself, I suggest, is a sign of the Bavli's ambivalence about redemptive almsgiving. It may be true. It may be true. But you know what? We're not going to argue about it at the end of the day. There are arguments for it. There are arguments against it. But we'll do Isaiah 58:7.
Yeah, no, I agree with your reading. I really like the fact that you mentioned the fact that he manages to just subtly ally the rest of the verse and the next verse, which is all redemptive.
Right. Isaiah 58:8, the very next verse. V'halach lefanecha tzidkecha, your righteousness, your tzedakah will march before you, is a glot redemptive almsgiving verse. And that's in none of the manuscripts, which fascinates me.
I only wonder one thing. Perhaps there's a more radical reading here, which is that what Rabbi Akiva is saying when he says Haidana, now is the time, is that he's reading God against God, right? That he's as you say, he's kind of conceding to Tornus Rufus that yes, we are avadim, we are slaves, because obviously the temple is destroyed. We're not doing the will of God. But, and therefore God wants us to be slaves or the poor, but still against God, we say what God said originally, give the poor your bread.
I like that. Using God against God. I think that's great.
All right. Well, on that note, this has been a pleasure.
Yes, it's been a lot of fun. So thank you for inviting me.
So my guest today is Professor Alyssa Gray, the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. And her new book, which everybody should run right out now and get after you've heard how brilliant she is called Charity in Rabbinic Judaism, Atonement, Rewards, and Righteousness. And that's with Rutledge Press. And I want to thank, of course, producer Ellie Unger-Sargon and the beautiful Unger-Sargon Studios. You can follow me on Twitter at IrMiklat, IrMiklat. Alyssa, are you on Twitter?
Yes, I'm Alyssa M. Gray 1 on Twitter.